Tantal Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Haunting of Crow House by A.W. James, narrated by Liam Gerard. Prologue, August 1st, 1892. Mary Kane fled through the moonlit woods, certain that her lungs would burst if she went any farther, but she dared not stop. The creature was right behind her. She could hear it crashing through the undergrowth, a low growl escaping its throat, and she knew that if it caught her, it would drag her to the deepest pit of hell, the very place from which it had surely been summoned. She also knew that she could run no longer. She had barely eaten for the past 4 weeks, surviving on only the thin gruel and holy water her husband had given her while keeping her shackled to the bed. Her wrists were rubbed raw and bleeding from the cruel iron manacles she had worn during her month of imprisonment, and she was sure that even if she managed to put a considerable distance between herself and her pursuer, the creature could simply follow the trail of blood she was leaving on the leaves and branches behind her. And not only her wrists were bleeding, the front of her white nightgown was stained deep red from the knife wound that traversed her stomach. The wound stung like 1,000 bee stings, but she was sure the knife had not penetrated deeply enough to cause more than a superficial cut. That was due to her reflexes. She had instinctively sprung back when the blade had slashed at her. If not for that quick movement of avoidance, she was sure the cruel knife would have cut into her stomach and bowels. Hot tears streaked down her cheeks, joining the ones that had dried there over the past weeks. She had endured so much, but tonight her suffering would end. She was sure of that. Even if she could escape the foul demon that followed her, her old life was gone forever. She could never return to it, not after what she had discovered tonight. Better to let the demon take her. But she feared for her soul. If the beast had truly come from hell, then to succumb to it would mean being taken to the fiery pit to suffer eternal torment. It seemed she had no choice, as the legs she had barely used in the past month had wasted away and would not carry her much farther, and her lungs burned like the fiery pit which she was desperate to avoid. Through the trees she saw moonlight glinting off water. The lake! If she could get to it in time, she would not cheat death, but she might yet save her soul. That shred of hope gave her a second wind, despite the searing pain in her lungs and screaming joints in her legs. The beast continued at a steady pace behind her and let out a growl that almost sounded like a laugh. Mary wondered if the foul creature was mocking her. It seemed to be enjoying the chase. It was so close that she could smell the foul stench coming off its body, yet it did not close the gap between her and it, even though she was sure it could grab her any time it pleased. "I'll show you," she thought. "If I can get to the lake before you take me, I'll show you." Finally, she burst through the trees and onto a rocky promontory that jutted out over the lake. She knew this place. It was close to the house. She had stood here many times, in happier moments, looking out over the lake with her husband and daughter. The water was deep here, more than deep enough for her purposes. Breathing hard, her raw wrists agonizingly painful, Mary paused for only a second before flinging herself from the rocks and into the water. During that second, she saw the glowing red eyes of the demon as it crashed out of the woods and onto the rocks. It did not seem concerned that it had lost its prey. On the contrary, Mary detected a vicious humour flicker across its inhuman features. The lake was icy cold, despite the fact that it had been a hot July day today. "No, it's August," Mary reminded herself. "The first day of August. Lammas Day. I'm going to die on Lammas Day." She could not swim. During happier summers when she'd visited the lake, John and Elizabeth had frolicked in the water, splashing each other and swimming so far out it almost made Mary's nerves burst, but she had always stayed on the shore, in the shade of the trees. Now she was in the water, and it was going to kill her. And in doing so, it would deny the demon her soul. She knew that killing herself was a sin, but surely God would see that she had only done so to avoid the fires of hell, and would take her to heaven in his mercy. But as she slipped beneath the surface of the cold water, she felt something grasp her ankle. She looked down to see a hand gripping her firmly. Then another hand appeared from the murky depths, and another, until there were hundreds of fingers wrapping themselves around her feet, ankles, and thighs. The lake water was cold, but the touch she felt on her legs was even colder, like a thousand fingers of ice grasping her legs. And as the hands dragged her down into the watery darkness, Mary realized that the lake was not only deep, it was unfathomably so, for it led all the way to hell. 1. Arrival. Present day. July 25th. "Here we are," Mike Wilson announced, trying to summon up an enthusiasm he didn't feel. "Our new home." He parked the Kia Sportage in front of the low stone wall that surrounded the house, close to the black wrought iron gate.
"Do we really have to live here, Dad?" Jen said from the back seat.
She'd looked up from her phone for the first time in an hour and was inspecting the house, a look of distaste curling her lips.
"It looks old."
"It is old," he told her, "but that doesn't mean we can't make it into a nice home for ourselves." The truth was, Mike didn't like the look of the house either, but beggars couldn't be choosers, and right now, his financial status placed him firmly in beggar territory. He'd had a great job in London, heading the sales team of an advertising firm, but the firm had gone bust thanks to the owners stretching the company's finances too thin, and the whole thing had collapsed in a heartbeat. Mike found himself out of a job and looking for employment in a competitive industry that didn't seem to have room for him anymore. Terry was making a little money selling her art, but it wasn't enough to keep them afloat, especially with the exorbitant rent they'd been paying for their London flat. Their savings were being eaten up at an alarming rate just to pay for food and bills. It was Mike's uncle Rob who had come to their rescue. Mike hadn't seen his mother's brother in years, but remembered him as a globe-trotting relative who turned up to the occasional family get-together with stories of exciting adventures in various parts of the world. Mike had been surprised when Rob had called him out of the blue, saying that he had a job for Mike if he wanted it. There was a house in Derbyshire that Rob had bought a couple of years ago as an investment. The property was vacant, and, since Rob was currently travelling in the Philippines, he had no way of giving the place the attention it deserved. He'd heard that Mike had fallen on hard times and offered him the house rent-free until he got back on his feet. All Mike had to do was tend to the neglected house and give it some much-needed care. Left with no other options, Mike had convinced Terry and the kids, and now here they were. Uncle Rob's offer had felt a little too much like charity, and that had left a bad taste in Mike's mouth, but now that he saw the house, he realised he'd have his work cut out for him if he was going to get the place into shape. Beyond the low stone wall, weeds and brambles had run rampant over the garden, strangling the life out of any flowers that may have once grown there. A flagstone path led from the gate to the front door, but this too had been lost to the twisting tendrils of the weeds. The house itself was overgrown with vines and moss, and some of the roof tiles were missing, pried loose by a length of creeping ivy which reached across the roof and down the walls and seemed to have claimed the house as its own. Mike glanced at Terry in the passenger seat. She was staring at the house with a resigned look on her face, and that hurt him more than any other expression her face might have shown. If she'd been horrified by the thought of the work ahead of them, that was one thing. If she were full of sorrow at the fact that their circumstances had brought them to this point, that was another. Mike could deal with those emotions by making light of the situation, or assuring her that this wasn't for long and they'd be back on their feet soon. But this resignation, this dulling of the spark of life that usually lit her eyes, was something Mike had never seen before, and it scared him. "We'll be okay," he told her,
She looked at him briefly and then got out of the car without a word. "I bet this place is haunted," Chris said from the back seat. "And I bet the ghost lives in your room, Jen." "Shut up, dweeb," Jen said, rolling her eyes before looking down at her phone again. "Are you getting a signal on that thing?" Mike asked, turning around in his seat to look at his daughter. The house was in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by bleak hills, thick woods, and not much else. The nearest village was a couple of miles away. He'd be surprised if there was a phone tower anywhere nearby. "Barely," she said, showing him the screen. The signal was just one bar. "This place really sucks." "Who are you texting?" He'd seen that she was typing a message, but hadn't had the time to see whom she was talking to. "Emma, I'm telling her this place sucks." "Jesus, we've only just got here," Chris said. "Give the place a chance before you diss it to all your friends." She looked at him and shot him a look of superiority. "You're just jealous because you don't have any friends." "Shut up," Chris retorted, before opening his door and getting out of the car. He slammed the door shut behind him and stormed off to the house. "You should go easy on your brother," Mike said. "He's just as upset about this move as you are."
"Well, he deserved it, telling me there's a ghost in my room."
Mike sighed. "There's no such thing as ghosts, so just let it go."
"I know there's no such thing as ghosts, Dad. That isn't the point. The point is that Chris is always on my case. It's because he's a lonely geek and I have friends and a social life. Well, I had a social life before we moved to this godforsaken place."
"Give it a chance, Jen. And as Chris's older sister, I expect you to look out for him, especially now we're going to be adjusting to a new place. Can you do that for me?" She frowned at him.
"He's 15, Dad. He's not a kid. He doesn't need anyone to look out for him. He should be able to do that for himself."
"Just humour your old man, okay?" She let out a long sigh and rolled her eyes. "I'm not promising anything." He knew that was the best response he'd get out of her right now. Everyone was tired from the 4-hour drive they'd made to get here from London. It was a hot summer's day and the motorway had been a nightmare. It seemed that everyone in England was making the most of the weather, heading to their favourite summer destination, causing traffic jams everywhere. And there had been roadworks slowing the traffic even more. Miles and miles of roadworks.
"Right, let's take a look at our new home," Mike said, opening his door and getting hit by the summer heat.
He'd never handled heat well and preferred cooler weather. Once the temperature rose above pleasantly cool, he felt drained and irritable. That was all he needed at the moment when everyone's tempers were on a short, frayed fuse. Terry and Chris were standing at the closed gate, staring at the abundance of weeds in the garden. Mike joined them and gestured to the gate.
"Who wants to be first inside?"
"You've got the keys," Terry said flatly.
"All right, I'll lead the way." The gate scraped noisily on the flagstone path as Mike pushed it open. "Hinges broken," he said, forcing it as far as he could before it jammed against the path. "That's job number one." He stepped through into the weed-infested garden and made his way to the front porch, caking at the tendrils and vines that grabbed at his shoes. The wooden porch felt surprisingly sturdy underfoot. Mike wondered if the property was in better shape than it had seemed at first. Maybe the only real work involved in getting the place shipshape was clearing the weeds out of the garden and the ivy and moss from the exterior walls. He stopped that thought before it went any further in his mind. He wouldn't be that lucky. There were probably leaking pipes and rotten floorboards inside. He took the keyring that Uncle Rob had posted to him out of his pocket and found one that looked like it should fit the front door. He tried it in the lock, but it didn't turn. "Maybe that one's for the back door," he mumbled to himself as he selected another key. The second key turned in the lock, and he heard a satisfying click as the latch opened. Terry and Chris had joined him on the porch, and he fixed a smile on his face that was supposed to convey to them that he was optimistic about what lay beyond the door, but probably just made him look silly. He pushed on the door, and as it creaked open, he wrinkled his nose at the smell of musty air that rushed out of the house. At least it only smelled of dust and mildew.
With the house being unoccupied out here in the wilderness, he wouldn't have been surprised to find dead animals inside.
Just because you can't smell them yet doesn't mean they aren't somewhere deeper in the house, he told himself.
He stepped inside and found himself in a wide hallway with a black and white chessboard patterned tile floor. A wide flight of wooden stairs ascended to a landing before continuing up to the next floor. A naked light bulb hung from the high ceiling on a length of wire, but Mike didn't need to turn it on because sunlight flooded in through a large semicircular window above the landing.
Wow, Chris said, walking into the hallway and turning around on his heels as he stared up at the high ceiling. This place is huge. Can I look upstairs, Dad?
Of course, Mike said. This is our home now. Terry appeared at his side, arms folded, eyes appraising the hallway.
I have to admit, it looks better inside than it does from the garden.
The condition of the interior had surprised Mike too, but he wasn't going to admit that. Obviously the place is so well sealed that the elements and the weeds can't get in. That's good. It means the windows are all intact.
We've only seen the hallway so far, she reminded him. Let's have a look at the rest of the house before we declare this move a success.
We'll make it work, he told her. And we're only going to be here until I get a new job, or your art takes off. You might be inspired by the countryside. Hey, maybe there's a spare room you can convert into a studio.
A flicker of a smile played over her lips. Are you trying to bribe me into liking this place?
He feigned an innocent expression. Who? Me? Never. She looked back out through the open front door, at the tree and the hills.
I suppose it might be nice to go for a walk every day and breathe fresh air for a change. Get back to nature.
That's the spirit. Now let's see what's through door number one. He went to the closest door and opened it. The room beyond was clean and tidy, with dark-stained wooden floorboards, a stone fireplace, and another bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling.
Ugh, that wallpaper, Terry said, following him into the room.
Mike hadn't noticed the wallpaper, but now that he looked at it, he didn't see anything wrong with it. It was a bit drab, he supposed, but that was probably because the yellow colour had faded over the years. Maybe it was the fleur-de-lis motif Terry didn't like. At least it's clean and dry, he said, running a hand over the smooth paper. No rising damp. Terry flicked a light switch by the door and the bulb sparked into life, giving off a sickly yellow glow.
It's a good thing this room has a big window, she said. That bulb isn't doing its job. It's going to be dull in here at night time.
I'll get some new bulbs, Mike offered. There's bound to be a place nearby that sells them. The people in that village we passed have to get their groceries and essentials from somewhere.
He decided to try and get her back into a more optimistic frame of mind.
Hey, this would make a great living room. There's plenty of space for the furniture and the TV, and we can build a fire at night. How's that for cozy?
She glanced at the fireplace and then around the room. I can see that it might have its charms.
Mike breathed out a sigh of relief. The state of the garden and the exterior of the house had made his heart sink, but it was actually so nice inside that even Terry was coming around to the idea of living here.
Come on, let's check out the rest of the place, he suggested. We need to get dibs on the largest bedroom before Chris lays claim to it.
They went back into the hallway where another door was now open, leading to a kitchen at the rear of the house. Jen was there, her back to Terry and Mike, staring out through a large window.
See anything interesting, Jen? Mike called.
She didn't respond.
Well, at least she's not staring at her phone for a change, Mike said to Terry as they walked toward the kitchen.
When they entered the room, the first thing he noticed was that it was spacious and airy, with windows running all the way along one wall. A marble-topped island sat in the centre of the room, and a large oven was situated in an alcove that looked specially built for that purpose. The kitchen cupboards were fashioned of dark wood, and the worktops were of the same marble as the island. Fluorescent strip lights ran along the ceiling. Jen was standing by the sink, still staring out of the window. Mike could see an overgrown back garden out there, a low rear wall and gate, and beyond that, a small lake.
Who needs a pool when you have a lake right outside your back door? He he said as he joined Jen at the sink. She looked at him, blinking, her eyes distant.
Huh? You okay, Jen?
Terry asked, concern in her voice. Jen shook her head as if to clear it.
Yeah, I'm fine. I was just looking around and I saw the lake and... I don't know. I just tranced out or something.
Terry shot Mike a worried look.
It's been a long journey, Mike said. We're all tired. It's probably just your mind taking a break from all the stress.
He put a hand on his daughter's shoulder. This move hasn't been easy for any of us.
Jen shrugged. It is what it is, Dad. I'm going to go and find a bedroom.
She went out into the hallway and Mike shouted after her, Not the biggest room, that's for your mum and me. From upstairs, Chris let out a long groan.
Sounds like he'd already picked the big room, Terry said, smiling.
That's my boy. Always has big ambitions.
But in this case, he's overreaching, she said.
Uncle Rob didn't mention a lake, Mike said, looking out through the window. The high sun reflected off the shimmering water, making bright patterns of dancing light on the nearby trees. The movement was mesmerizing, hypnotic.
No wonder Jen had tranced out looking at it. Mike could see how staring at the flickering light might be restful after the long car journey they'd just endured. He could already feel his mind loosening, the tight muscles in his shoulders relaxing.
Did Rob say why he bought this place? Did he live here at one time? Terry asked.
No, Mike said, pulling his gaze away from the lake. He bought it on a whim, sight unseen. Rob does everything on a whim. He probably planned to flip the place and sell it at a profit, but then his next adventure came along. He told me he's never even been here.
Terry raised her eyebrows. He bought a house he's never seen. He must have more money than sense.
He said it was really cheap. I can't believe that. A big house in the middle of nowhere with a lake at the bottom of the garden?
Depends on your idea of cheap, I suppose.
She sighed, and Mike sensed the resignation returning.
Come on, let's go and find our bedroom and get the sleeping bags out of the car, he said.
Terry left the kitchen and Mike followed, resisting an urge to look at the lake again. It seemed like a harmless action to stare at the sunlight on the water for a while. But something deep in his subconscious, some part of him that was concerned with self-preservation, told him to resist the temptation.
2. Warning. It was early evening when Mike drove back along the road toward the village. Terry and Jen had opted not to come on this food run and were unpacking the boxes they'd brought to the house. Those boxes included some food items, but Mike had suggested they get fish and chips from the village. He was sure he'd seen a chip shop when they'd driven through earlier on the way to the house. Chris was in the passenger seat, playing a game on his iPad. Mike could hear the whoosh of swords and shouts of pain coming from the iPad, but he had no idea what the game was.
How are you doing, Chris? I'm losing my castle to a bunch of dragons.
I don't mean in the game. I mean with this move. You haven't said much about it.
Your mum and Jen aren't happy that we came here, and they tell me so at every opportunity. But you haven't said anything.
I'd like to know your thoughts on the subject.
Chris shrugged.
It's fine. I don't really care one way or another.
But you liked London?
Yeah, sure.
Mike gestured at the trees lining the road and the rolling hills in the distance. This is nothing like London.
Dad, you need to get with the times. It doesn't matter where you are geographically anymore. Everyone is connected through the internet. As long as I have a device in my hand, it doesn't matter if I'm in London or in a house in the country. It's all the same. Life is lived online these days.
Well, your life is. Your eyes are always fixed on a screen.
My point exactly. Everyone lives in a virtual world now. Everything we need is there.
Mike frowned at that. He knew his son spent a lot of time on a computer, and he'd worried that Chris might be eschewing the real world. But he hadn't realised it was this bad.
Not everything, Chris. Maybe you should take a look around you every once in a while, at things that are real. This is a beautiful part of the country. Some fresh air would do you good, instead of spending all your time on those games and chat rooms.
Chris raised an eyebrow.
Dad, You know that games and chat rooms are my life, right? I mean, this is going to be my job someday. This is how I'm going to earn a living. Yes, of course, I know that. But that doesn't mean you should ignore everything else. Maybe you should be more forward-thinking. What's that supposed to mean?
Chris returned his attention to the iPad.
Nothing. No, come on. I want to hear what you have to say. You think I'm old-fashioned or something?
I didn't say that.
No, but you implied it.
Mike could see a sign ahead, half obscured by the long grass at the side of the road. As he drove closer, he saw that it said, Shoreby.
All I mean is that if you had a job working in IT, or if you had a knowledge of coding, then you wouldn't have... Never mind. It doesn't matter.
Mike didn't push his son to finish the sentence. He knew what Chris was going to say, that if Mike had knowledge of computers, he wouldn't have lost his job, and by extension, they would still be in London, living their old life. He didn't say anything else as they drove into the village, which consisted of a single main street lined with shops and a couple of side roads that led toward clusters of houses. Mike wondered if there'd be a chip shop here after all. There was a pub, of course, called the Shoreby Arms, and a corner shop that probably served the villagers' needs when they didn't want to drive all the way to Matlock, which was the closest town, and which Mike knew had a supermarket. He scanned the other businesses as they drove by. An antique shop, a bookshop, a Chinese takeaway and a charity shop.
There's the chippy, Dad.
Chris had lifted his head from the iPad long enough to have a look around and was pointing ahead of them. A lit sign showed an image of a cartoon fish carrying a bag of chips with the words Shoreby Fish Bar beneath its tail. Mike found a place to park among the half-dozen cars that were parked outside the establishment. When he looked through the windscreen into the brightly lit chip shop, he realised this was the most popular place in the village. A queue of people stood at the counter, and others were sitting at plastic tables and chairs that had been set up inside, eating their meals. They got out of the car and entered the shop. Inside, the smell of oil in the fryers and battered fish behind the glass made Mike's stomach rumble in anticipation. But the heat was stifling. He had no idea how the two girls serving at the counter or the elderly man frying the chips could stand it. By the time it was finally their turn to order, Mike wasn't sure what he was looking forward to more, getting their food or escaping the heat of the shop and getting outside where it was cooler.
"What can I get you, love?"
the girl behind the counter asked him. He realised she really was just a girl, probably Chris's age. The other woman serving looked like an older version of her and was probably her mother. He gave her his order, which he'd written on a piece of scrap paper before leaving the house, and she busied herself fetching the food and putting it into cardboard boxes.
"All right, mate."
The elderly man, who was probably the owner, gave Mike a friendly nod as he lowered a fresh basket of chipped potatoes into the fryer.
"Hi," Mike said. "I haven't seen your face before, so I'm guessing you're passing through, or on holiday."
Mike guessed that in a village like this, the chip shop owner probably knew all of his customers by sight, if not by name.
"No, we've just moved here," he said, "so you'll be seeing a lot more of us from now on. I'm Mike, and this is my son, Chris."
"I'm Stelios."
He frowned, as if trying to remember something.
"So you've moved into the old Roberts place on Ashtree Avenue, right?"
"No,"
Mike said, shaking his head. "We're not actually in the village. We're a few miles away." Stelios grinned.
"Well, I hope the chips are worth the drive."
"I'm sure they will be."
The girl finished packing their order into a paper bag and took Mike's money. After he got his change, Mike handed the bag to Chris.
"Here, make yourself useful."
Chris raised his eyebrows and looked like he might protest, but cast a quick glance at the girl behind the counter and said,
"Sure, Dad."
When he opened the door onto the street, Mike felt a welcome breeze of cool air. He stepped onto the pavement and breathed deeply.
"Oh, I thought I was going to suffocate in there," he told Chris.
As they reached the car, a voice from behind them said,
"Excuse me."
Mike turned to face a man who appeared to be in his 70s. He sported a thick salt-and-pepper moustache and wore a flat cap. He was dressed in a tattered dark blue jumper and black trousers that were tucked into a pair of scuffed army boots.
"I heard you telling Stelios that you've moved into the area," the man said. Excuse me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?